My name is Krista, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone, and thanks to Heidi for asking me to be here today. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. Since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you will learn what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and understanding. Luz will read the preamble.
Hello, my name is Luz, and I'm an alcoholic. The preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Cassandra will read the steps.
Cassandra, alcoholic. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thanks.
Thank you. Roland will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Roland, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
It's a big night. It's anniversary night. Woo! Come on. The format of the meeting will be the 10-minute speaker will speak on the sixth tradition, followed by our information break. Then the main speaker will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our big anniversary celebration. Our 10-minute speaker is Phil.
Hi, I'm Phil. I'm an alcoholic. We begin this with me reading the long form of the tradition, I believe. So let me get that. Tradition 6. Problems of money, property, and authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. We think, therefore, that any considerable property of genuine use to AA should be separately incorporated and managed, thus dividing the material from the spiritual. An AA group as such should never go into business. Secondary aids to AA, such as clubs or hospitals, which require much property or administration, ought to be incorporated and so set apart, if necessary, that they can be freely discarded by the groups. Hence, such facilities ought not to use the AA name. Their management should be the sole responsibility of those people who financially support them. For clubs, AA managers are usually preferred. But hospitals, as well as other places of recuperation, ought to be well outside AA and medically supervised. While an AA group may cooperate with anyone, such cooperation ought never go so far as affiliation or endorsement, actual or implied. An AA group can bind itself to no one. So thank you, Heidi. It's a real honor to speak in front of this group, especially to speak on a tradition in front of the Atlantic Group, a group that takes the tradition so seriously. I hope something I say here tonight will be useful to someone else. I definitely overthought this. I want to do a perfect job, which of course means I'll do less perfectly than I would have otherwise. So there's a few things. I think the issue of AA owning property is kind of a settled issue, so I'm not going to focus as much on that, even though that's what the long form talked about. In 1939, that was a real concern. Bill talks in the 12 and 12 about, actually, just to quote it, he says, "The moment we saw that we had an answer for alcoholism, it was reasonable, or so it seemed at the time, to finance any enterprise, whatever, in the total field of alcoholism. In fact, we felt duty-bound to throw the whole weight of AA, the AA name, behind any meritorious cause." And he had a lot of ideas about hospitals, rehabs, textbooks, lobbying Congress for changes, and they learned through a lot of hard experience, how problematic those things were. And I want to speak more about the reason why those things are problematic, and that gets more to the other half of the sixth tradition, the part about outside organizations and putting the AA name on things. Traditions 6 through 11, this one and the next few, all have something to do, as I see it, with a threat to Tradition 5. Tradition 11 talks about individuals becoming the representatives of AA, spokespeople, and their egos getting involved. 10 talks about getting caught up in issues other than alcoholism. 9 talks about having too much organization, bureaucracy. 8 talks about professionalizing 12-step work. 7 talks about taking money from outside AA. They all have to do with getting diverted from our primary purpose. And our primary purpose is to help the alcoholic who's still suffering. So why does 6 get involved in that? If linking the AA name to another group could help further the cause of people getting help. How could that possibly be a problem? In both the 12 and 12 and AA Comes of Age, Bill tells the same story in different wording about the alcohol industry, a trade association for the alcohol industry approaching AA and approaching a member of AA to ask them to be their spokesperson for a campaign to reach out and say, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you shouldn't drink, and if you're not an alcoholic, use moderation. It's kind of similar to the Drink Responsibly kind of campaign they've done recently. And at first, they thought it was a great idea. But as they thought about it more and as they looked into it more, they realized two things. One was that the alcohol industry was hoping to give their PR campaign respectability and prestige by associating the AA name to it, which is not necessarily something that it deserved or that we wanted to get into. But they also realized that then another organization that's for abstinence, that believes alcohol should be made illegal across the country, might get another AA member to be their spokesperson. And AA would get caught up in arguing over different, in the public sphere, over different ways to approach the issue of alcohol. It's not directly related, but to me this reminds me of what I saw going on a little bit in the 80s during the self-help era. With a lot of gurus out there and a lot of different messages, a lot of them using 12-step language. And I really feel strongly that one of the reasons AA survived all that is that it never got caught up in it directly. Somebody might claim an association, but AA never did and never expressed an opinion about any of it. Forgive me for the fact that I'm using notes. I just want to make sure I don't forget anything important, because doing the tradition in front of the Atlantic Group is such a serious endeavor. Bill says something else, though, in the 12 and 12, which is, and I'm quoting him again here, "Of course, there couldn't be the slightest objection if such an association hired an AA member solely because of his public relations ability and his knowledge of alcoholism." So the sixth tradition doesn't say that we should stay out of the alcoholism business. It doesn't say that we shouldn't share what we know with other people. It doesn't say that, you know, all this wonderful knowledge we have about recovery should be kept secret from the rest of the world. Its concern is with associating the name of AA with those things. And this has personal relevance to me because I write a column. I'm a columnist about spirituality, and I sometimes talk about recovery. And, I've learned a lot in these rooms about that that I find helpful to share with others. But I never associate myself with AA. I never mention that, you know, I'm in AA, never place myself in a meeting, and I never say AA says such and such. And so by doing that, I'm respecting the anonymity thing, which is, not tying myself to it and maybe helping the impression that I have authority because of using it. But I'm also respecting the sixth tradition of not bringing AA into the picture. And if you think about it, if you do a little mind game with it, you know, if I said I'm in AA, then everything I say people would think potentially was coming from AA, and I'm not always going to say things that are conference approved narrowly. The second thing is they'll assume that anything else in the publication where I'm publishing might be in some way associated with AA. It's a Catholic magazine. Are they going to think AA is a Catholic organization because they see it there? If they read something in another article that says something different about recovery that isn't written by me, are they going to get confused? So as long as I'm just sharing my knowledge and sharing what I know and what I've learned, and I'm not associating myself, I'm not placing myself in a meeting, other people might have different opinions, but at least by the sixth tradition as I read it, that kind of work is okay. And as I said, and there are lots of people who are in recovery who work in rehabs and work in other aspects of the recovery field. And, I don't believe that we're being asked to hide our gifts or to not share what we know from others. Now, linking money and resources, the risk there is entangling our mission with their mission. I did a lot of work in politics, and I saw how whoever had the money and who could ever mobilize people was going to control the agenda. And, that may be the way politics is supposed to be. It's representing those people. But imagine if the AA message could be altered by where the money was coming from or who we chose to associate with because at one time it seemed like a good idea. You could play that both ways. I mean, imagine that an organization was willing to give us millions of dollars and millions of members, you know, if we toned down the God talk a little bit. Or maybe we had to tone up the God, like maybe they wanted us to talk about Jesus specifically more. So it's just keeping again to our pure principles as expressed in the traditions and not getting caught up with any other organization. So I've run out of time almost. I just want to conclude with how I see this kind of fitting into a bigger picture. So I see the bottom line for Tradition 6 is the last part, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. There's lots of good things that can be done with money and property. There are a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily be corrupted by prestige. But the AA purpose, which is to help other alcoholics, hard-earned experience taught our founders and continues to teach us over and over that can be threatened, that can be at risk if we get caught up in money, property, and prestige. Bill said that the goal of the sixth tradition is to divide the spiritual from the material. And he mentioned studying how St. Francis set up a monastic order with corporate poverty and using that as a guideline. The key to Tradition 6, as I see it, is, and some of the other traditions, is attachment to the material. You know, that becoming attached to things in the material realm, money, property, alcohol, status, pride, takes us away from the spiritual. It cuts us off. And we're afraid of losing what we've got or not getting what we want. We get involved. Even if no money's involved, we get into power plays with other people. We think we've got to get our result out of a business meeting because it's this illusion of scarcity. If somebody else gets what they want, we don't get what we want, and we end up in competition with other people. So all these fear-based lies are ultimately rooted in forgetting that we're okay, that we're not running the show, to accept things as they are, and to trust that these traditions have worked this long and they'll continue to work. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name's Elizabeth Young, and I am an alcoholic. Woo! I have a new appreciation for coming into this meeting. It's a completely different experience when I come every week and I'm not the speaker. I mean, completely different. And I just, you know, I take that for granted that I get to come here each week. This meeting runs so smoothly, and it's my home group. I'm an alcoholic. I got sober May 2nd, 1999. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. And, you know, the reason I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous is because I have no choice whether or not I pick up a drink. I have 10 years sober, May 2nd, 1999, and I still have no choice whether or not I pick up a drink. I do have a choice, though, today to seek a power greater than myself, or actually remove the blockage that blocks me from a power that keeps me sober in a moment-to-moment, day-by-day basis. And I'm truly grateful, because when I was new, when I first got here, there's a lot of day counters tonight. I had no idea what was wrong with me. None. For 28 years, I tried to figure it out. I relied on myself to try to figure it out. And even when I got here, you know, my first couple of years, it was all sort of just following the person that went before me. So I say that I'm powerless because I just didn't know. I didn't know alcohol was my problem. I didn't know I had an illness that was of mind and body, and I'll talk more about that. What it was like. I grew up around alcoholism, so I had plenty of warnings. You know, the big book in Bill's story, he talks about ominous warnings I did not heed. That's my experience. I had a dad who was an alcoholic. He loved to drink. He was a violent drinker. I had a godmother who loved to drink, and she was one of those love drinkers that wanted to hug you when she was drunk. And it freaked me out. They both freaked me out. And, you know, and this was young, 5, 6, 7. My first relationship with alcohol started when I was about 7 or 8. And this just came to me. I always said, up like through the years of being sober, I don't remember my first drink. And I still don't remember my first drink, but I remember my first relationship with alcohol, my first experience with alcohol. And it was about 7 or 8. I had a lemonade stand on the corner of Wyman Avenue in Staten Island, where I grew up. And we were selling lemonade for 10 cents, and me and my friend. And this guy came up and said, "Do you have any beer?" And I didn't even bat an eye. I said, "I'll be right back." I ran 3 houses down to my house, into the kitchen, opened the refrigerator, stole a beer from my parents, ran back to the lemonade stand, said, "Here you go." And he gave me $2. This is pretty cool. He came back a little later with a buddy and asked if we had any more beer. I did the same thing for 2 of them. That was me. I looked around and things were chaotic. So I knew the people around me had no idea how to handle or manage life. So I figured I'd take it on myself. And from that age, I was earning my own money, and I would have told you that, from my paper route at 16, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, first drink I had, I was about 15, 16. Again, I don't really remember like the first little sips. I know I went into my parents' cabinet and all that, but the first experience, basically, the first time I drank with people, you know, I was in high school, it was at a party. This really cute guy that I was totally crazy for, he kind of reminded me of John Travolta. But he wasn't. He was just like a little older, and he was cool, and he had that flip, and he was just whatever. But he was pouring tequila and 7-Up in these shot glasses, and then we would bang them on the table and drink them back. And I remember standing at that table looking at him, like wanting to say something, but not. I'm just incapable of connecting with other human beings or anything around me, ever. And I just was like, you know, I'll have one of those, whatever it is. And I just stood there, and I did shot after shot after shot. And that was pretty much the first time I drank. I was able to talk, I'm sure. The second thing that I remember a couple things from that night, because it was also my first blackout. But one of the other things I remember is that he looked at me with that look. That look that I got throughout the years from my mother, from my brother, from people around me that loved me, that just were confused by my behavior, and they didn't know what was wrong with me. Anyway, that night, whatever, I remember one thing of people trying to help me go to the bathroom, of all things. And that's really all I remember of that night. Through my teens, I tried to control my drinking, because from the get-go, I knew that I never knew what was going to happen when I picked up a drink. So from the time I was that drinking episode until about 19 years old, through high school, through business school, I was driven. And I would drink occasionally, and things would happen, you know. I'm not going to get into all the details, but the bottom line was I couldn't control what I was going to do. And not only couldn't I control it, I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know what was going to happen. So by the time I was 19, I remember I didn't move into the city. I got a job in the city, and I had that sort of I have arrived feeling. And, you know, again, here I was in an environment where there was like people that were working there that were a little older. I wanted to connect to them. I didn't talk, really. And if I did, I was full of fear. I was driven by fear. I didn't know it at the time. I mean, now being here and looking back, I can see that I was driven by fear and self. And so I went out. You know, I went out. I got invited to this party for this woman that I worked with, and I just really looked up to her because she was older and she'd been working in the city for years. And I went to the party and I drank. I picked up a drink. I'm an alcoholic, and what I do is I drink. I picked up a drink, and then, you know, after I picked up the first drink, all bets were off, and It wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty. Incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I wanted to connect, and the way that I tried to connect was often alcohol took me to places that were not pretty. So I woke up the next day somewhere in Queens. I remember it was light. There was a lot of light. And I was in a bed, and I just looked over, and I started crying. And, you know, the person, you know, the gentleman that I was with, and I say that, but he didn't say a word, just got dressed, and we went, and he took me to work. And I went to work that day, and as if nothing happened. And this was my experience over and over with alcohol. My 20s, I kind of gave up trying to control drinking. I started to not really care what you thought about me, so I drank a lot. I worked at a restaurant, and I went out for a couple of drinks, and it ended up not being a couple of drinks. I got engaged because I thought that would fix it or help me solve my problem. I figured that was it. If I got married, then, you know, then this hole or whatever was inside of me that wasn't being filled would be fixed, and that didn't work. That just ended in drunken brawls with my fiance in the bar, you know, whipping the ring across the parking lot and getting Grand Marnier spilled over my head and, you know, just insanity. So I drank like that until I was 26 years old. And when I was 26, I visited my first hospital, and I just went out to have dinner. I didn't intend to go to a hospital. And I had a couple of drinks, and I, by the way, I always had a hostage. I was never, ever single from the time I was 15 until I got here to you. I always had a hostage, at least one. I was at dinner with this particular hostage, and this person had told me we worked together, and she had said it was done. We were not going to be, you know, together anymore. I don't even want to talk about how. You know, anyway, let's just say that it was done. So I have a couple of drinks, and because I have no self, you know, I get my self-worth from, at this point, from everything external. Everything external. There's no Elizabeth unless I'm leeching on to something outside of me. You know, no matter what, money, power, prestige, relationships, all that stuff. And so this person, I think I have a couple drinks, and, you know, I'll change her mind. I didn't change her mind. And so I was rejected, and I went home, and I thought it'd be a good idea to have, thank you, to take my life. So I took a bottle and a half of painkillers. And then the next day, the police came, took me out of my home in handcuffs. You know, talk about alcoholic delusion. Or self-delusion, I didn't see the reason or the need for handcuffs, you know. And when they told me that I was a danger to myself and others, I thought they were overreacting. And then, you know, I wish I could say that was my end, but it wasn't. You know, from that point on, I was searching. I was searching. I went on a lot of spiritual retreats, silent retreats. An alcoholic on a silent retreat is not pretty. Not pretty. It was very painful. Very painful. And I realized I couldn't drink alcohol. I knew I couldn't drink alcohol, okay? So I didn't drink it for almost a year, and then I entered my second institution. I went and checked myself in to rest my nerves into a mental institution. Just like I think it was Fred or one of the guys in the big book. I really identify with that because I wasn't an alcoholic. I just needed a break. And then, you know, the insanity of the first drink. I got out, and a month later, I'm walking in the West Village. It's beautiful outside. The sun is shining. I just got out of therapy, and I think I'm going to go to the bar and have a salad. And I really, really, I wish that wasn't me every time I say that, but that's really what I thought. And, you know, that's that mental piece. You know, I suffer from an illness that's of mind and body. When I take a drink, the drink takes a drink, and we've heard this many times. If you're new, you know, I have a craving. A phenomenon happens to me, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that when I took one, the reason I didn't know what was going to happen was because I just kept consuming alcohol. My body needed the alcohol. And then I have an alcoholic mind, which basically means that I think it's a good idea to go into a bar to have a salad after I just get out of a psych hospital. I mean, so, you know, my journey was a year later I got to you. And what happened for me was I was going to Al-Anon too, by the way. This is important because there were alcoholics around me. They were the problem. I was not the problem. So I was going to Al-Anon to try to understand them. And there was this one woman that would come in each week. I would go to this problem-solving meeting. You put a problem in the basket and people answer if they have experience on the solution. And this woman would come every week with a 9-month-old baby. And the 9-month-old baby was clean. And she was clean, and the baby looked happy and fed. And anyway, it's a program of attraction, and I was drawn to her. And my last drink was on a Saturday, and I went to that meeting on Sunday. And, you know, when I took that last drink, I saw the one and only time my obsession for the drink. I always thought I was a person who really loved deeply, and I just couldn't find my other half, you know, or I was wronged, or if they would only understand how I feel. And, you know, that night that God revealed to me that I had an obsession that was more powerful than anything or anyone I said I loved was truly a grace, you know. It was a gift. And I got here. I came into a meeting. That woman, I asked, you know, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? Because I didn't know. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I knew what my dad looked like. I swore I'd never be like him, and I ended up being exactly like him because I have the same illness as him. Only he died of this disease. He didn't get it, you know. He died in a room alone on the border of Mexico in, like, Arizona. And, you know, this is a deadly disease. And if you're in this room, you're really, really, really lucky because we don't all get a chance to come here. Or my dad came here, but he knew better than we did. He knew better than the big book. He had a lot of self-knowledge, and he used to tell me about it. And it killed him, you know, it killed him. So I got here, and I had to learn that self-reliance wasn't working. You all asked me to admit I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. I could not see it. Thank God I had a sponsor to walk me through and show me what unmanageable looked like because not paying your bills and not going to work was not unmanageable for me. That was fine. I was used to living the way I was living and, you know, the self-delusion. So I was also asked to find a power, you know, find a power. I love the idea of not making any major changes in your first year, yet admit you're an alcoholic and turn your whole life over to something you don't even know exists for real, for sure. Like, it's kind of interesting, but it works. It really works. Thank you. And what I did in the beginning in that coming to believe is I believed that my sponsor believed. You know, I believed when I was at that meeting and I said, you know, I need a sponsor. And my sponsor came up behind me and said, I need a sponsee. And the sponsorship lady said, you too. And I looked at that woman and I was like, and next thing you know, I'm at a diner next door eating eggs and she's next to me. And then there's this guy and his sponsor and the guy's sharing about how his wife just had a baby and they're all talking to each other. And I'm like, I can't do this without a drink and I'm eating eggs. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I just kept following her. I believed that she believed, you know, and I got to that point in the book where it talked about, you know, God is either everything or nothing. And the great thing is that God can be a God of your understanding. I was just talking to a newcomer before the meeting, and we were talking, she was expressing to me how hard it is to pray and to find that power. And how, you know, when she prays, she doesn't feel it. And, you know, when I first got here, they told me I didn't have to feel it. Some days I don't feel it, but that it's there, and that the practice of seeking the power truly works. It truly works. So then I did a moral inventory. I did steps 4 through 9, and basically, thank God, because my whole life was finger pointing. It was other people's problem, everybody else's fault. And the fourth step and the fifth step finally got me to the place where I was able to take responsibility for my actions and my behavior. I'd never, ever done that in my whole life. It was always your fault. And so to look at it in black and white and share it with somebody else was a profound experience for me. It wasn't a feel-good experience. I saw my sponsor in meetings afterwards and didn't feel good. But slowly, little by little, you know, there was a change. Something happened. I'd never told anyone everything, the things I promised I'd never tell. And then we made a list of my defects, and I became willing over time to have them removed. That's a process. And then I made nine-step amends. I made my eight-step list. And the ninth step, and, you know, these four through nine, and the reason that I'm talking about them is because these were all the things that were blocking me from the power that has the power to keep me sober. You know, that power that I call God, that is my God, is like a force that's beyond being reckoned with. It is huge. It is so electric. And all this gook was blocking me, you know, blocking me from the power. And when I did four through nine, and I practiced these steps on a daily basis by practicing 10 and 11, the junk, the self, which really is my main problem, you know, the selfishness, the stuff, me, Elizabeth, my world, is removed. And I actually have an experience with a power, you know, a power that really does solve all my problems, you know. So I made a lot of nine-step amends. I made all my nine-step amends, actually. One of the best amends that I made was with my stepdad. And I didn't talk about him, but he was my dad since I was 5 years old. My alcoholic dad, mom divorced, and my dad. And I always hated him. Because he, like, took the place of my dad, and I just was very angry at him. And, you know, when I made my amends to him, he was dying of pancreatic cancer. And I remember it was, like, the winter, and I went there, and I did the script, as my sponsor guided me to do, and I shared with him the harms that I had done. And then I asked him if there was anything else I'd left out. And he shared for, like, an hour. He shared about what it was like to be a stepfather, and he shared about what it was like to be married to my mother. And, you know, this was in December, and he died January 5th. And after he talked for about an hour, he laid down on the bed, and he said, "I don't know about you, but I feel great." And, you know, we don't know what these amends, why we're doing them. I know they remove for me the blocks that keep me blocked from God and you, but what they do for other people, like, I have no idea. That this work is really powerful. Thank you. Let's take some water. It's hot up here. No, I'm not done yet. I have 5 minutes. So what do I want to say in 5 minutes? So I did the amends. I finished my amends, the ones I'm aware of. I recently heard a speaker say, his sponsor told him, now pray for the amends you're not aware of. I like that. And then 10 and 11, you know, what do I do today? What's my life like today? Wow. I recently had an experience where I asked a couple of women if they thought they were powerless over, if they had a choice to pick up a drink today. And all three of them answered yes. And they're in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they have different amounts of time, and they all were taken through the steps, one by me, and two by other women. And it made me think, you know, about my own powerlessness and whether or not I have a choice, even though the picture book blatantly says I don't have a choice. And, you know, I kind of got to the place where I could see for myself, having some time, being in 10 and 11, thinking, you know, now that I'm connected to this power, yeah, I wouldn't consciously go pick up a drink. But earlier I said, you know, I have an illness of mind and body. And when I straighten out, in the book it tells me that when I straighten out spiritually, that I'm healed in the mind and the body area. And I just paraphrase that. I didn't say it exactly like the book. But the point is that if I'm not consciously connected to the power that has kept me away from a drink for 10 years and a couple of weeks. I'm going to drink, because in the book, you know, me having a salad in that bar in West Village, and in the book it talks about over and over, you know, the alcoholic mind and how it will lead me back to a drink. And so I started to question and ask myself, you know, what do I really believe? And the way that I know what I believe is by looking at my actions. What am I doing? I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I very rarely listen to what people say. I very rarely listen to what I say. I look at what I'm doing. I look at where my feet are. I look at what my actions are doing and saying. And I had to really, you know, admit to myself that I wasn't praying and meditating every morning. I was praying, but I wasn't meditating. I wasn't sitting in the silence. I wasn't seeking out other forms of spiritual connection like the book tells us. And I had to just see it and recognize that at 10 years sober, the daily practices, I still have to do these things. Yes, I have sponsees, and yes, I go to meetings, and yes, I have commitments. But if I fail to enlarge my spiritual life, I'm going to be like Jim. I mean, Jim had, in the book, years sober. I don't know how many years, but he had a few years sober. And he failed to enlarge his spiritual life, so he got drunk. You know, I am driven. I am a creature that is driven by 100 forms of fear, selfishness, self-delusion, just like the book says. That's my experience. And what I needed to do was go through the book and find, is it my experience? You know, and if you're questioning, if it's your experience, from that questioning and asking these women, we started a big book where we meet on Sundays, the four of us, and we're going through from step one, and we're scouring it, and we've been on it for about 4 weeks now, just on the first step, you know, looking at the powerlessness. What does it mean to admit I'm powerless over alcohol? In my mind, sure, no problem, got it. But in my heart, what does it mean, thank you, in my heart to admit that I can't choose whether I pick up a drink? And if I can't choose, I've got to have an experience with something that can keep me from it. And how do I have that experience? You know, how do I practice 10 and 11, you know, on a daily basis, watching, looking, asking? All of these things. There's so many wonderful directions in the book. And if you're new and none of this made sense, just keep coming, because it didn't make sense to me for a long time. And, you know, nobody said, don't come. But I do urge you to sit down with somebody and see if you're a real alcoholic. You know, it's very easy to see. You can find it in the book. And somebody, everybody here, I'm sure, a lot of people here would be willing to sit down and walk you through it, so that you can find out for yourself, because the solution works. And I'm really grateful. Thank you so much, Heidi, for asking me to speak.